rapper for the people. 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Elise. On today's show, host Latara Smith interviews Keith Carnes, an inmate in Missouri who says he did not commit the crime for which he is serving time. Latara has studied Carnes' case, read transcripts of depositions and trial testimony, interviewed experts, and sought out witnesses in Kansas City's toughest neighborhoods. Smith believes that Carnes is serving a life sentence for a murder he didn't commit. Should be fascinating. Stay tuned. But first, Latara Smith.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio. I'm your host, Latara Smith of the Casey Freedom Project. And today, I am blessed with the privilege and honor to be able to interview Mr. Keith Carnes. Keith Carnes is a Jackson County, Missourian who has been incarcerated for the last 18 years within the Missouri Department of Corrections for a crime that he says he did not commit. Mr. Carnes, are you there?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you so much, Mr. Carnes, for having me, giving me the opportunity to be able to interview you today and allowing us in the community to be able to know more about your case.
Thank you, guys.
So let's just get right in on the questions. Mr. Carnes, can you tell me what exactly have you been convicted of?
I was convicted of first-degree murder and armed criminal action.
And what sentence were you given, Mr. Carnes?
I was sentenced to life without parole in the Department of Corrections.
Okay. Are you serving one life sentence or two?
One.
One. Okay. All righty. And so your case is out of here in Jackson County, Missouri. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And who was your prosecutor on your case?
I had Amy McGowan as my prosecutor, and then I got Don Parsons.
Okay. So you had two prosecutors, Amy McGowan and
yes.
Don Parsons.
Yes.
Okay. How did you end up with two prosecutors? That's kind of confusing.
Well, Amy McGowan was the original prosecutor, and then issues that she was having already in Jackson County, which I suppose led her to Kansas, where she became a prosecutor. And before she left, she transferred. I remember having a court hearing when everything got transferred over to Don Parsons as a new prosecutor before Amy McGowan left.
Okay. So Amy McGowan started off in your case as the prosecutor, was
yeah.
hands-on and was the assigned prosecutor, and then left Jackson County for whatever reason and
right.
went over to Douglas County, Kansas, where she became a district attorney over there. And at that point, Don Parson took over your case.
Yeah.
Okay, we just want to make sure and make that clear for those in the community, our listeners, to understand exactly, you know, where we are with that, because that's a little bit confusing.
Okay,
okay. So you ended up with two prosecutors. Now, let me ask you something, Mr. Carnes. You were convicted, according to information that I have received, based solely upon the testimony of two eyewitnesses.
Yes.
Okay. Was there any physical evidence or anything that connected you to this crime?
No, ma'am.
Not one piece, not at all?
Not one piece.
Okay. Well, no physical evidence, and they went just basically by the testimony of two eyewitnesses, and that was absolutely it. You know, a lot of people, Mr. Carnes, don't understand how easy it is to get convictions on people with no evidence, literally going by just what somebody else says.
Yes.
Have you seen that often?
Yes, I have.
You have? And so, with that being the case in your situation now, you served how long in the Jackson County Jail before you were actually found guilty and sent off to the Department of Corrections?
I sat in the Jackson County Jail from 2003 to the end of 2006.
Okay. Now, you had two different trials, is that correct? You had more than one. Can you kind of shed some light on that?
Well, when Amy was my original prosecutor, a trial date was set, and that trial was dismissed due to their witness problems.
Okay.
So before I could get released or anything, she refiled on me immediately. So months later, I went to trial.
Okay, so when you say witness problems, are you referring to witnesses?
The state's witnesses.
Okay.
So they wouldn't show up or whatever problems. It says whatever problems they were having with the witnesses, they didn't want to show up.
Okay, so at that point, the witnesses didn't show, and they filed to dismiss, and then Amy turned around and immediately refiled against you, correct?
Right, and during that process is when she had her issues with them, and she transferred the case over to Don Parsons.
Okay, so then Don Parsons picked up where Amy McGowan left off.
Yes, and then I went to trial, jury trial, and lost, but I got a new trial due to their witness, one of their witnesses that they say was a key witness, showed up at the 11th hour.
Uh-huh.
And my lawyer asked for an objection because we were trying to find a certain witness for like 18 months so we could do a proper deposition before trial. And we were all surprised that she came in like the last day of trial, and the judge said, "Well, go out into the hallway and talk to her and then come back in."
Okay.
So he went through that process. She got on the stand, said a whole bunch of, testified to a whole bunch of things that my lawyer was not prepared for. He argued at my sentencing that I was prejudiced by that. Judge agreed, gave me a new trial.
Okay. Okay. Now, is this a situation where the witness was held in the county jail? Is that where the witness was, if I remember correctly?
She was in custody, yes. She was in custody.
Okay. So the witness was in custody?
Yes.
Okay, when she came in to testify against you.
Yes.
Now, Mr. Carnes, I know you said there was no physical evidence against you, which led to your conviction. I know that you said it was based upon the eyewitness testimony.
Yes.
Now, there was another state's witness, which would have been the medical examiner in your case.
Yes.
Who was the medical examiner at that time here in Jackson County, Missouri?
Dr. Thomas Gill.
Dr. Gill. And Dr. Gill, being a medical examiner, I'm sure that his medical report played some part in your court case. I'm sure that it came up. I'm sure that it was part of the discovery process. Would you agree?
Yes.
And what exactly did your ME report say? And what did the ME report in your case say?
Well,
what was Dr. Gill's ruling in the medical report in your case?
Well, in my first jury trial, when he took the stand, his medical report said that the witness's testimony was inconsistent with the physical evidence because the witnesses were testifying that they witnessed the victim being shot point blank range and stood over, and through his expertise, he said that that was not possible due to the lack of damage and all type of other medical reasons that he said that it was inconsistent.
Okay.
And he said that it was a distance shot because point blank range, as they testified, there's a certain look that it would have, stipplings, gunpowder, which he says clings to the clothing. No shell casing set right there where they say someone stood over, or said that I stood over him and shot him extra amount of times. No shell casing, no dent impressions up under his body from him being shot that would damage and disturb the concrete up under him. And for all those reasons, he said it basically said that it was inconsistent with the eyewitness's testimony.
Okay. That's what he testified to. But what I was asking you about was the specifics of your ME report, which stated, and this is the point that I was trying to pull out of you, which stated that there was, it was a distant gunshot wound.
Yes.
Okay. Distance meaning at least 2 to 3 feet away. Yet, the witnesses in your case testified that you stood directly over the victim. I believe one stated you turned him over and shot him probably 5 times, and the other one said you didn't turn him over and shot him once. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
One stated that after he fell, that I turned his body over, shot him five extra times from point-blank range with an AK-47. The other witness stated that she knows what an AK-47 looks like. It was a pistol. She didn't see anybody get turned over or hear five extra shots that I just stood over him and shot him one time in the head with a pistol.
Okay. So I want to make sure that everyone understands that your wrongful conviction came about as the result of no physical evidence. Let's for sure bring that out. But also based upon the eyewitness testimony of two eyewitnesses. Two totally different stories. Two totally different situations. One said a pistol. Right. One said a pistol. One said a gun. One said shot once. One said shot it probably five times. None of this added up at all. Totally opposite and contradicting to the ME reports, who states that this was not an upfront, close range shot.
Exactly.
And yet you were convicted.
Yes.
Now, we know now, you've been locked up how long, Mr. Carnes?
16 years and about 6 months.
So now going on 17 years that you've been incarcerated within the Department of Corrections.
Wrongfully incarcerated.
Wrong. Okay. But what I'm saying is, all this time that you've been in the Department of Corrections, even though at the beginning, during your trial, you know, I can hear the inconsistencies. I've actually seen the inconsistencies in your paperwork. And it just knocks me off my feet that we have prosecutors and investigators and detectives and people as such that could not see these contradictions in your case.
And that's why I wanted to say, because I got a new trial after this evidence was brought into my first trial. Well, the dismissal, then the first trial, then I got a new trial. Now, at the new trial, I did a bench trial.
Okay, can you explain to our listeners?
The jury could overlook all these inconsistencies that didn't make sense. They were contradicting the physical evidence. So I figured I'm going to do a bench trial because a judge, he has to examine the facts and rule accordingly. But evidently, he did the same thing.
Okay. So I just want to explain to our listeners what a bench trial is versus a jury trial, because many people don't know, Mr. Carnes. A bench trial is where there's a judge, and he is the person who decides. There's no jury. There's only the judge, the prosecutor, the defendant, and their attorney. And the judge makes the determination of what happens with that entire case. So, Mr. Carnes, you're saying you opted to have a bench trial because you thought, you know, that a judge would consider the actual facts of the case and understand it better from a legal standpoint. Is that what you're saying? Okay. Now, here we are now. Let's kind of speed up a little bit.
Okay.
We know that you had Amy McGowan as a prosecutor. We know that Amy McGowan is titled as a problematic prosecutor. We know that she was responsible for the wrongful conviction of Ricky Kidd. She played a part there, committed a lot of acts of prosecutorial misconduct, as well as we know she has a history of prosecutorial misconduct, several cases over in the Kansas side.
Yes.
And she was the prosecutor in the beginning of your case. And there's also, in reference to your case, according to some eyewitness recantment statements, that Amy McGowan acted not accordingly in your case. Is that correct?
Yes. Threats from what eyewitnesses that testified against me are saying now in the affidavits that they were threatened with jail time and coerced.
Okay. We don't want to go into too much detail, but we do know that the eyewitnesses have recanted, and according to their affidavits, it does most definitely lean towards some prosecutorial misconduct committed by Amy McGowan, which we all know that she has a history of doing.
Right.
So, and, you know, we know that. And I say we, as in Latara Smith and the Casey Freedom Project, and also people who know of Ricky Kidd's wrongful conviction, who have seen in the media, who knows everything that she did in his particular case as well. So I just want to make sure I clarify that as we, meaning we as in the Casey Freedom Project, and not more so the opinion of the station here. But Mr. Carnes, with all of that being said, because I believe we're coming up to the end of our interview here, I think we just have a few more minutes. Your case is puzzling, because here you are. There were several eyewitnesses. There were several eyewitnesses that put you someplace else besides at that actual crime scene. Is that correct?
Yes.
And were any of these witnesses called to speak on your behalf? What happened?
No. And it surprised me, because a lot of witnesses that have been contacted now, years later, were wondering why they weren't contacted when they were right there when the police did the canvas of the crime scene. One witness that was right across the street from where the body was at, he said he called the police. And his affidavit clearly proves my innocence, because he said he watched the whole thing when the victim fell. You know, the evidence clearly shows that the person that shot the victim, the only evidence that shows that the shooting took place were the 12 gun shells, which were a block down the street, which would indicate that he got shot from the person that was shooting was right there and shot him as he, I guess, ran up the street.
Okay. Because eyewitnesses have placed you down the street in an apartment building and coming out on the porch of the apartment building after the shooting. I mean, during the time that the gunshots were going off and things as such, witnesses, more than one, have placed you down the street in an apartment building and then coming out right there on the front porch looking as everyone else was looking as this shooting was going on. If I remember correctly, isn't that the situation in your case?
Yes, everyone was looking, wondering where the shots were coming from, and all you could do was see the victim running up the streets, and you just heard gunshots, but you didn't see anybody.
Okay. Wow. That's puzzling. That really is, and I don't know how all these important things, important facts, because, you know, Mr. Carnes, we see a lot of wrongful convictions. Every day out here in the public, we see cases that are turned over, and people are getting out of prison. Like, someone every week is getting out almost, who has been wrongly convicted and served multiple years, some of them even decades in prison. We see them get their cases overturned. We see that often out here. And we see cases where there's much more than just witness recantment. And your case has all of that. Has witnesses recanting, physical evidence not adding up, witnesses who were never interviewed, people who have surfaced
misconduct.
Now.
Botched, you know. Investigation. You know, there's a lot of factors in my case that thankfully now will come into light the next time that I go to court or file a motion in court.
Okay. You sound like something's going on with the phone there. Make sure that you're up where I can hear you, because you're kind of coming in and out a little bit on my end here. So.
Yeah. I was saying prosecutorial misconduct. I was agreeing with you as far as all the factors that are in my case. I was saying prosecutorial misconduct, botched investigations.
And once again, everyone who is listening, thank you for tuning in to KKFI 90.1 FM. I'm your host, Latara Smith of the Casey Freedom Project, and I am interviewing Mr. Keith Carnes. Mr. Carnes is a Jackson County, Missourian who has been incarcerated within the Missouri Department of Corrections going on 17 years for a crime which he says he did not commit. Thank you for tuning in. Mr. Carnes, so back to your case real quick here. You have witnesses who put you down the street at the time the crime was committed. You have an ME report that specifically says the wound that caused the victim's death was a distant gunshot wound with no evidence of soot, strychnine, or gunpowder. I believe it's how it's worded. You have witnesses who have recanted. Okay. And to top it all off, you had a problematic prosecutor that was involved in your case in the beginning who has a history, who is known for committing acts of prosecutorial misconduct. Yet your case is one that our Jackson County, Missouri prosecutor refused to address or even refused to look at and make right through her conviction integrity unit. That is all correct, am I?
Yes, that's correct.
I'm sure I'm not missing anything out here.
That's correct. No one wants to take accountability for their wrongs.
Right. And that's not right. That's really not right. And so for those who are listening, I want you to know that, you know, if we have a conviction integrity unit here in Jackson County, Missouri, you know, I would think that our local prosecutor, Gene Peters Baker, would most definitely want to look at cases that had some pretty good proof and, you know, pretty good facts and paperwork there that could line up, as in Mr. Carnes, and would say, you know what? I'm going to uphold my ethical duties. I am going to abide by my responsibilities as a prosecutor, and I'm going to look into this case, and I'm going to consider all these facts. I'm going to take into consideration these affidavits and this newly discovered evidence that has come about in this man's case, and I'm going to do what's right. But that's not what Miss Baker did in your case, did she?
No, she didn't.
She just disregarded your case and basically said it's out of her jurisdiction, correct?
Yes. All the evidence has been presented to her and the Kansas City Police Department. And no one wants to take accountability and give me my rightful day in court so I can bring all this evidence to light. Get my freedom back.
I am so glad that you brought up the Kansas City Police Department. I know that was not in our list of questions, but toodles to you for bringing that up because, of course, I'm getting ready to come back on that. Yes, the KCPD, they hold up responsibility when it comes to your wrongful conviction, because people have actually named the real killer, and they have refused to reopen the case and investigate the claims of the people who had come forward and actually named the killer in your situation. Isn't that correct?
Yes, in light of all the evidence that shows that I'm innocent, with all the facts and witness and recantations and physical evidence never being placed there to even find me guilty, and they still don't want to do what's right.
And I think that's really sad because we see the KCPD asking people in the community to talk and to help with cases out here all the time, yet they have information in reference to the case that involves you, and they have never addressed that. Well, Mr. Carnes, we're coming to the last part of the interview. Really quick here, what would you like to say?
Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the Laws of Justice for giving me this opportunity to talk about my case. I'd like to thank all the supporters of the KC Freedom Project that have been following my case, supporting me. And I'd just like to thank God for placing you people in my life to give me the opportunity to expose this corruption that our justice system is doing to me.
Okay. Well, I tell you what, I'm sure that everyone here at KKFI sends you a great you're welcome, and we appreciate you coming on the show to talk about your case because it's most definitely of interest to us, your case and other cases where individuals are saying, hey, I am innocent and wrongly convicted. Mr. Carnes, thank you for coming on the show. You have a blessed day. All you listeners, thank you for tuning in. Everyone have a wonderful day.
Thank you, everybody.
Did you know your business or organization could be sponsoring this episode of Jaws of Justice Radio? Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
Eco Radio KC, a locally produced exploration of positive solutions to the ecological challenges we face as we work to create a healthier future for our community and the planet. Hear from regional and national guests, find out about upcoming events, and learn how to keep yourself and your family well. Tune in each week from 6 to 7 on Monday evenings or listen anytime at kkfi.org/podcasts.
Now the calendar for the week of January 27th. Corey's Network will have their weekly meeting, Ivers Workshop, on Monday, January 27th. East U.S. Highway 40 in Independence, Missouri. The church is east of the Hy-Vee on 40 Highway. Corey's network asks us to please join their weekly meeting to learn how to deal with grief, the media, investigation, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. This is a workshop and not a grief group. Please include only those individuals mature enough in age to deal with the issues being covered during the meeting. Check their website, coreysnetwork.org, or phone 816-866-7868. Grandparents Against Gun Violence will meet Monday, January 27th from 4 p.m. at Colonial Church, 7039 Mission Road, Prairie Village, Kansas. GAGV has invited several organizations that will tell how they are impacting the serious number of crimes with guns in the Casey Mo area. Park on the east lower level and enter the same level on the east side. ACLU of Kansas has a Smart Justice Lobby Day, Monday, January 27th, from 10 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. at the Kansas State Capitol, 300 Southwest 10th Street, Topeka, Kansas. Our state prisons have exceeded capacity for more than half of 2018 and much of 2019. The ACLU of Missouri is determined to reduce mass incarceration through policy change. There is a crash course in how to be effective advocates for ACLU of Missouri's upcoming Voices of Liberty Lobby Day from 6 to 8 p.m. Monday, January 27th at the Mid-Continent Public Library, 317 West U.S. Highway 24, Independence, Missouri. There will also be Lobby Day training on Tuesday, January 28th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the ACLU Kansas City office. 406 West 34th Street, Suite 420 in Casey Mo. Free parking in the adjacent lot to the building. On Tuesday, January 28th, 10:30 to 3 p.m., you can join Empower Missouri and the Smart Sentencing Coalition to advocate for powerful, meaningful criminal justice reform at the state capitol in Jefferson City. 308 East High Street, Suite 100 in Jefferson City, Missouri. Tuesday, January 30th, there's a safe space drop-in at the Lawrence Public Library Atrium Study Room, 707 Vermont in Lawrence, Kansas. Trained advocates from Willow Domestic Violence Center will host drop-in sessions in an informal and confidential setting where you can learn the full range of crisis, advocacy, and support services offered. Visit lplks.org for more information. On Saturday, February 1st, Moms Demand Action Missouri asks us to observe National Gun Violence Survivors Week at 3:30 p.m. at the Casey Mo Public Library, Blueford Branch, 3050 Prospect Avenue, KCMO. My name is Elise, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank all our volunteers, and please listen next week.
I want to welcome everyone to Jaws of Justice, a program of 90.1 FM KKFI. Now, I'm happy to have as my guest Michael P. Kay, Washburn University Law Professor Emeritus. Michael, tell us a bit about yourself.
Well, first of all, I don't have a middle name, but thank you for giving me one. It's Michael Kay, but I will tell you about myself. I taught at Washburn since 1979, where I was a teacher in the law clinic and in the classroom, and in criminal law, criminal procedure, evidence, and trial advocacy. My interest has been in community justice, in alternative dispute resolution, and labor law. And so I spent most of my time doing that until I retired about a year ago, at which point I got involved with the 501 school district here in Shawnee County. I had been the chair of the Topeka Police Department Grievance Review Board, which heard appeals by police officers regarding either contract issues or discipline issues. And that's how I got to know Major Ron Brown, who was one who helped me administer it. And he left the department. He retired, and he became the chief of the 501 Police Department. So at that point, I met him again and asked him if he'd like me to help out with the new Juvenile Justice Reform Act that was came into effect in 2016, in July. And he welcomed me, and thanks to that, I spent the last year training officers, observing them in the school setting, and learning a lot about MOUs and about the juvenile justice system. And we drafted an MOU this year as a result of this new act, which I greatly support.
Well, Michael, that is nothing short of fabulous. And for our listeners, let's have a clear understanding. Unified School District 501 is in Topeka, Kansas. It's in Shawnee County, Kansas. And our topic today is the pipeline to prison. We have a clear understanding that unequal opportunity within the public school district causes this pipeline to prison to occur. The term has emerged from our observation of the modern criminal justice system, where our understanding of the statistics on the impact of repeated involvement with the criminal justice system displays racial disparity in the statistics. And we know the problem of suspended futures when applied to children. There's a clear correlation between education and prison. Michael, explain how you became interested in this topic.
Well, I think that as a lawyer, especially a lawyer dealing with constitutional law and criminal justice issues, you can't not be interested, really, in the sociology of this. You know, why some people end up in prison, others don't. How, where you go to school, what your family is like, affects your entry into the justice system at a time when, for other people, the entry is into college. And so, I was also active in the ACLU. For a number of years, and I just seemed to me to be very interesting. And actually, I couldn't explain to you really, but when I saw that there was a new criminal Juvenile Justice Act, it struck me that just standing there talking to Ron was that was the way I could be helpful. And so that's sort of what brought me into it. You know, I think that from my own point of view, when we talk about racial and ethnic disparities, you know, we're talking about percentages. We're talking about different treatment for similar behavior between students of color and students who are not of color. We're talking about an unnecessary entry, for example, into the justice system and deeper penetration even. And that usually, I think, from what I've seen, is the result of criminalizing normal adolescent behavior. And sometimes simply school misbehavior, that because somebody thinks they don't want to tolerate that kind of behavior in the school, it gets thrown to the justice system. And this new statute is a remarkable redoing, recasting of our juvenile justice system. Kansas gets a lot of bad publicity. There's no question about it. I just, you know, the legislator that talked about African-Americans having a genetic predisposition to using marijuana. Shameful publicity across the country.
Step off the committee.
And it makes national publicity because we're known for it. But this statute is remarkable, and it was passed with 100% of the votes in the Senate, 188-5 vote in the House in Kansas, signed almost immediately by the governor, and it was the result of the legislature putting together a work group of made up of a large number of stakeholders in the justice system, legislators and prosecutors, judges, defense lawyers. This couldn't have been done better, and it's incredibly ambitious. So now the story is going to be, will it work? And for it to work, there has to be collaboration. So all this, you know, makes me very interested.
This is where you come in. I found you looking at a Capital Journal article, the Topeka Daily Capital Journal, mm-hmm. where you're the author of a model memorandum of understanding between the school district in Topeka, Kansas, and the police. So you're offering this model memorandum of understanding to all school districts in Kansas to adopt. Is that correct?
Well, we're not, in a way it is. In the first place, I think you should, let me just, for your listeners, they might want to understand what an MOU is and how I got involved in it and our district got involved in it. Memoranda of understanding are not a new device. They're not a new type of agreement. What they are is memorandums of understanding is an agreement between agencies and people who are working together. It's not supposed to be a legally enforceable agreement. It's an agreement based on trust. Some of them are like contracts, and they might actually be enforceable in a court. But basically, the actual idea behind them is that people who are working together sort of pledge to trust each other and work this out, sort of a cooperative plan. And the new Juvenile Justice Reform Act requires school districts to develop and approve what they call the Memorandum of Understanding. And not only do they, each one has to have one, and they had to have one by July 1st of 2017, this thing had to be developed in collaboration with what they called relevant stakeholders. So, for example, it would be between the school district and a law enforcement agency, the district attorney's office, the Department of Corrections. It could include community groups like the NAACP, neighborhood associations. And it's up to the school district who the stakeholders would be. And the purpose of this MOU is clear guidelines for how and when school-based behaviors are going to be referred to law enforcement or to the juvenile justice system. And the statute says, with the goal of reducing such referrals and protecting public safety. So when I saw this, I and Ron got together to work on this. And I went and took webinars, for example, from the leader in MOU production, Judge Teske in Clayton County, Georgia, who goes around the country helping districts to design their MOUs. And all these MOUs are considered to be unique to the district. So, for example, Garden City might have a very different type of MOU than Topeka would have. So we worked on that. And then we got involved. We got the general counsel for the Topeka 501 district to work with us on it. And among us, we developed a draft. We then talked to the new superintendent and asked her to convene a meeting of stakeholders. And so then we had prosecutors, we had the presiding judge of the district, we had corrections people, we had people from the school district. And that's when we discussed this particular draft that we had and to see if we could get buy-in. And then after we had done that in one large group, we met again in small groups, we worked on the language, and out of that came this collaboration that produced this MOU. Now, as far as other people go, we are overjoyed if anybody wants to use it and, you know, adopt it or change it. But for all I know that Wichita, for example, has one. Their school system is very advanced when it comes to this stuff. And there may be others that have them also. But we're willing to share it, absolutely.
Each individual school district would have to sign a memorandum of understanding with their local law enforcement.
Well, I don't know whether Missouri has done this or not. This is entirely a, you know, state law thing.
We can only encourage them.
Encouraging them to do it?
Right.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, here's the reason, and I'll tell you. One thing that's very important to understand is there was a Bar Journal article by a juvenile court judge who says it's a whole new world now, and he describes this new act as a complete redoing, almost unbelievably vast redoing of the justice system and the juvenile justice system. And the purpose of this, the primary absolute purpose, is to reduce racial disparities and to keep all kids out of the justice system unless they absolutely have to be there. And to make that work requires buy-in from a huge bureaucracy, in other words, and from the public. And so for that to work, the MOU is extremely important, because the MOU is something that will be in the hands of teachers, school administrators, parents can read it, the police department, the school police department.
The sheriff.
And kids know about it.
Right, so we see reasons.
This is a thing that will make it run. In other words, they're like the engineering department at GM, and this thing is the car. You know, this is the operating manual for the car, and that's how we're doing it.
Right, we see the trigger of racial disparity in offenses, the number of offenses. There's a disproportionate number of black students charged with suspensions compared to their general overall school population. And there's two things that I found in my research that cause this. One is a zero tolerance policy, an exclusionary policy. Here's the rule. Anyone who does this is suspended. And then the other is, in fact, the policing in schools. So in the modern world, we have police officers in schools. And as a result of this, we're seeing more incarceration of youth because the police have been misused in public school. So the MOU is getting away from the idea of a police officer as a hall monitor. Isn't that correct? There's clear.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, number one, yes, zero tolerance policies are inconsistent with the new law. There's no question about it. Not only that, we're not writing on a clean slate here. I mean, it's well known that zero tolerance policies feel good to people not involved in the application of the policies, but they not only don't do anything, but they don't do what they're supposed to do. They don't prevent recidivism, and they also end up being quite cruel. As far as policing in the schools go, I would say this. During this last year that I've been involved with this, I've had a chance to see police at work. So, for example, I've spent time with the officers in the 501 Police Department and the high schools and the middle schools, you know, shadowing them and seeing how they deal with that. I've also participated in training them in effective interaction with students and with school staff. And we've put on about four training sessions through our own 501 Police Department on this very issue, not only in our school but elsewhere. And what I've found is that, first place, police are used to being trained. Training is an important part of their work, self-training. They treat kids out here with respect. They mentor them. They're not looked upon as the enemy. And they are the one group, I would say, that is most likely to understand and treat all kids appropriately, regardless of economic or racial issue. Now, when it comes to the schools, here's the problem, and you see this not only here but in other states. Once a police officer is in the school, the officer's in a somewhat delicate position because they're there for safety purposes, and safety means that they'll problem solve, but they're there to prevent crime, and if there is crime occurring, to stop it or investigate it. What do school teachers think about that? Well, some school teachers understand it perfectly. Others don't. And the problem that this law is intended to address, and you see it in our MOU also, is police should not be asked to do school discipline, which is the province of administrators and school staff. In other words, if a teacher is having trouble with a kid who won't put his cell phone away, you don't call the police officer in and say, take that away from him. If you're having trouble with a kid in the classroom who just won't listen or who keeps on talking and who's violating school regulations on behavior, you don't call the police officer in and say, get him out of here. And this problem, unfortunately, throughout the country, is one that police are very sensitive to because they see, you might call it mission creep. They see the school encroaching on their, taking advantage, really, of their presence to try to use them for something they're not intended to do. And Ron Brown and I wrote an article that's coming out in February in the Kansas Association of Police Chiefs magazine about this, because once a police officer is brought into the school classroom or the school environment, and a student starts to treat them perhaps in a way they might be treating a teacher, you know, rudely, unwilling to cooperate, maybe even pushing, the officer finds that they have to deal with that as a police officer because they're dealing, their authority is now being challenged. And what this can mean is that other kids seeing it are going to think, well, we don't have to listen to the officer. He's, you know, just, we can push him around too. So they sometimes have to take action. If they have to do that, they're now potentially going to detain a kid or arrest a kid, the one thing they don't want to do. So these problems are ones that the police are now used to facing, and the MOU should reduce that. Now, the other thing is causes of racial disparity, I don't think come, in my experience here, from these officers. We have our officers are racially different. In other words, we have black officers, we have white officers, we've got officers who've got Asian background. But what happens is that kids are going to be pushed around, suspended, detained very often because school teachers don't understand what they're doing and think that a black kid, because they talk a certain way or act a certain way, is committing a form of school misbehavior that has to be responded to by some form of discipline. And that's one of the causes of racial disparity. You know, the only way to find out what why you have racial disparity is to dig down, to try to investigate, talk to everybody, and find out why they're doing what they're doing. Because we do have a black kid in Shawnee County is 4.5 times more likely to be suspended or sent to juvenile intake than a white kid.
Well, we do have other ways to find out, Michael, and that is that, didn't you tell me you're having an upcoming event at the school building that's the national site of Brown versus the Board of Education?
Yes, we are.
And when is that?
Well, you know, there's an example of the type of process that you want to see in a community. In other words, this idea of collaboration means that since you're interested in community alternatives to detention and community input, you've got to go to the community and talk to them. So, as it turns out, Ron Brown told me that there was going to be a movie shown about the prison, the pipeline to prison, the school to prison pipeline, and that they were having a panel and they were going to have the superintendent on it. Ron was going to be on it. A former school board member would be on it and asked me if I'd like to join. So we're going to go there next Friday on the 19th at the Brown site. It's open to the public.
And what time will that be?
We're going to talk. You know, we're going to see the movie and we're all going to talk about it. And we hope, of course, just as you're suggesting, that the public is there the people who care about this issue, and we can find out what they think, you know.
We have run completely out of time, and I thank you very much for being such an interesting and engaging guest. Let's tell the people again, January 19th at the National Site, which houses Brown versus the Board of Education, the Monroe
in Topeka.
School in Topeka, Kansas. And what time will that event
be? It'll be at 6 o'clock will be the film, and the film lasts about 50 minutes, and then there'll be a half an hour in discussion.
So the entire public is invited, and it's an absolutely free event.
Right.
Yeah, thanks. I thank you very much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Teresa Wilkie. As some of you detected, that was not a live segment. Our live guest this morning did not call in. We called the live guest twice, and they evidently forgot about it or they had some kind of a problem. So we had to quickly throw that in there, and that was previously heard on KKFI. So thanks for listening to that. Up next is Richard Mabian. Of course, coming up here at 10 a.m., Dr. Mike, with all your favorite classic country, bluegrass, oldies, a lot of old-timey music. Stay tuned.
Community Voices is a production of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is our way of letting the voices of our neighbors be heard. Any opinions and views expressed are those of the speakers only and not necessarily those of Midcoast Radio Project, KKFI, board, staff, or volunteers.
This is Richard Mabian, one of the hosts of Eco Radio. It comes on Monday nights at 6 p.m. And what I wanted to bring to you, they could call me the Green Czar. So Kansas is in the process of getting a climate health declaration signed. And this declaration goes, we believe in community resilience. The Kansas Climate and Health Declaration aims to increase awareness of the impact of climate change on the public health, to increase civic engagement on climate action in Kansas, and to advance policies that build community resilience and safeguard the future of our state. They're in the group called Climate Energy Project is in the process of getting people to sign on to this declaration. As president, which I am, of the Kansas City, Kansas NAACP, we signed the declaration. We agree with the American Health Association and believe climate change has a direct impact on vulnerable populations in our community. Children, seniors, low-income communities, community of color, immigrant community, those with chronic disease, pregnant women, indigenous people, and people with disabilities will be most impacted. We actively support community leadership in addressing the adverse effects of climate change. This is Richard Mabian for Community Voices on KKFI Community Radio.
It's the 420 Drug War News. In 2003, I was in San Francisco the night before a normal conference, N-O-R-M-L. I was standing out front, and a gentleman walked up and asked if I wanted to buy some weed. He had a Tupperware container full of weed and edibles, and as I was looking through his offerings, he yelled out, "Hey, Terry, come here." And while I was looking there, the gentleman walked up, and the seller said, "Dean, this is Terrence Hallinan, the district attorney of San Francisco." Well, I nearly dropped the Tupperware and ran, but I didn't, and I stayed and I shook his hand, and it was the first day I learned to respect a district attorney. Sadly, Terrence Hallinan has recently passed away at the age of 83, but this is part of my interview I conducted with D.A. Hallinan back in 2003.
Yes, sir, I don't know how much chance you get to hear the news from Texas, but I'm hoping that you've heard of the Tulia scandal, the Dallas Sheetrock scandal, the Houston Crime Lab.
No, I don't know of those.
Well, I'll brief you quickly on what I think is the most gregarious of them, outrageous of them, and it's the Tulia scandal, where they arrested 39 black people in one night, all for cocaine charges, though when they made the arrest, no drugs, no weapons, no money was found.
Yeah, I remember reading of that now that you mentioned it.
Yes, sir. And the recent happenings with it is that a gentleman, Tom Coleman, who was the sole support for all these arrests, he had no backup whatsoever except what he had written on his leg, and he was indicted for perjury. And yet it seems now they're going to take months, if not years, to let the people go that are in prison based on his testimony.
Uh-huh.
It's
people he's convicted in the past, you mean?
Yes, sir. And they can't seem to figure out how to get them out of jail.
Yeah, difficult.
Yes, sir. I realize it's a Texas matter. I probably should stick to medical marijuana, which I think we both have a great understanding of. I first off want to tell you how grateful I am for your efforts to share the truth in regards to medical marijuana, and your speech at the Normal Conference was just wonderful.
Well, thank you, Dean.
Yes, sir.
And, of course, I've seen the truth of it here in San Francisco where, everybody in this city knows somebody who swears their life is being prolonged by the use of marijuana. Yeah, the people in some of the clubs or clinics, whatever you want to call them, there's no question they're full of sick people, you know.
Terrence Hallinan, a pioneer in marijuana reform, dead at 83. I am Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it some way, somehow?
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.
Yo, this is Scott Colwine, 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.